Everybody on a commitment who gets up publicly to speak starts out saying he's an alcoholic, says it whether he believes he is yet or not. Then everybody up there says how grateful he is to be sober today, and how great it is to be active and out on a commitment with his group, even if he's not grateful or pleased about it at all. You're encouraged to keep saying stuff like this until you start to believe it, just like if you ask somebody with serious sober time how long you'll have to keep schlepping to all these goddamn meetings, he'll smile that infuriating smile and tell you just until you start to want to go to all these goddamn meetings. There are some definite cultish, brainwashy elements to the AA program. The term program itself resonates darkly for those who fear getting brainwashed. And Gately tries to be candid with his residents regarding this issue. But he also shrugs and tells them that by the end of his oral narcotics and burglary careers, he'd sort of decided the old brain needed a good scrub and soak anyway. He says he pretty much held his brain out and told Pat Montesian and Gene M. to go ahead and wash away. But he tells his residents he's thinking now that the program might be more like deprogramming than actual washing, considering the psychic job the disease's spider has done on them all. Gately's most marked progress in turning his life around in sobriety, besides the fact that he no longer drives off into the night with other people's merchandise, is that he tries to be just about as verbally honest as possible at almost all times now, without too much calculation about how a listener's going to feel about what he says. This is harder than it sounds. But so that's why on commitments, sweating at the podium as only a large man can sweat, his thing is that he always says he's lucky to be sober today, instead of that he's grateful today. Because he admits that the former is always true, every day, even though a lot of the time he still doesn't feel grateful, more like shocked that this thing seems to work, plus a lot of the time also ashamed and depressed about how he spent over half his life, and scared he might be permanently brain damaged or retarded from substances, plus also usually without any sort of clue about where he's headed in sobriety, or what he's supposed to be doing, or about really anything at all, except that he's not at all keen to go back out there behind any bars again in a hurry. Ferocious Francis G. likes to punch Gately's shoulder and tell him he's right where he's supposed to be. So, but also know that casual attribution, like irony, is death, speaking on commitments-wise. Crocodile's temple veins will actually stand out and pulse with irritation if you start trying to blame your disease on some cause or other, and everybody with any kind of sober time will pale and writhe in their chair. See, for example, the white flag audience's discomfort when the skinny, hard-faced advanced basics girl who gets up to speak next to last posits that she was an 8-bag-a-day dope fiend because at 16 she'd had to become a stripper and semi-whore at the infamous Naked Eye Club out on Route 1. A number of male eyes in the audience flash with sudden recognition, and despite all willed restraint, automatically do that crawly north-to-south thing down her body, and Gately can see every ashtray on the table shake from the force of Joelle V's shudder. And then, but that she'd had to become a stripper at 16 because she'd had to run away from her foster home in Saugus, Massachusetts. And that she'd had to run away from home because, here at least, some of the room's discomfort is from the fact that the audience can tell the etiology is going to get head-clutchingly prolix and involved. This girl has not yet learned to keep it simple because, well, to begin with, she'd been adopted. And the foster parents also had their own biological daughter. And the biological daughter had, from birth, been totally paralyzed and retarded and catatonic. And the foster mother in the household was, as Joelle V. put it later to Gately, crazy as a fucking mudbug. And was in total denial about her biological daughter's being a vegetable. And not only insisted on treating the invertebrate biological daughter like a valid member of the chordate phylum, but also insisted that the father and the adopted daughter also treat it as normal and undamaged, and made the adopted daughter share a bedroom with it, bring it along to slumber parties. The speaker uses the term it for the invertebrate sister. And also, to tell the truth, uses the phrase drag it along rather than bring it along, which Gately wisely doesn't dwell over. And even to school with her, and softball practice, and the hairdressers, and campfire girls, etc. Where at whatever place she dragged it along to, it would lie in a heap, drooling and incontinent, under exquisite mother-bought fashions, specially altered for atrophy, and top-shelf Lancôme cosmetics that looked just lurid on it. And with only the whites of its eyes showing, with fluid dribbling from its mouth and elsewhere, and making unspeakable gurgly noises, completely pale and moist and stagnant. And then, when the adopted daughter, now speaking, turned 15, the rabidly Catholic wacko foster mother even announced that, okay, now that the adopted daughter was 15, she could go out on dates, but only as long as it got to come along too. In other words, that the only dates the 15-year-old adopted daughter could go out on were double dates with it and whatever submammalian escort the speaker could root up for it. And how this sort of stuff went on, and how the nightmarishness of its continual pale, soggy ubiquitousness in her young life would alone be more than sufficient to cause and explain the speaker's later drug addiction, she feels. But that also it so happened that the foster family's quiet, smiling patriarch, who worked 0900 to 2100 as a claims processor for Aetna, it turned out that the cheerful, smiling foster father actually made the wacko foster mother look like a Doric column of stability by comparison. Because there turned out to be things about the biological daughter's utterly paralytic pliability and catatonic inability to make anything except unspeakable gurgly noises that the smiling father found greatly to a certain very sick advantage. The speaker says she has trouble openly discussing still, even at 31 months sober in AA, being as yet still so retroactively wounded and hurting from it. But so, in sum, that she's been ultimately forced to run away from the adoptive foster's Saugus home, and so become a naked eye stripper, and so become a raging dope fiend, not, as in so many ununique cases, because she had been incestuously diddled, but because she'd been abusively forced to share a bedroom with a drooling invertebrate, who by 14 was itself getting incestuously diddled on a nightly basis by a smiling biological claims processor of a father, who, the speaker pauses to summon courage, who apparently liked to pretend it was Raquel Welch, the former celluloid sex goddess of the father's glandular heyday. And he even called it Raquel in moments of incestuous extremity. And how, the New England summer, the speaker turned 15 and had to start dragging it along on double dates, and then having to make sure to drag it back home again by 2300 hours, so it had plenty of time to be incestuously diddled. That summer, the smiling, quiet foster father even bought, had found somewhere, a cheesy rubber Raquel Welch full-head pull-on mask with hair, and would now nightly come in the dark, and lift its limp, soft head up, and struggle and lug to get the mask on, and the relevant holes aligned for air, and then would diddle his way to extremity and cry out, "Raquel!" And then, but he would just clamor out and off and leave the dark bedroom smiling and sated, and lots of times leave the mask still on it. He'd, like, forget or not care, just as he seemed oblivious, but for the grace of God, in a way, to the fetally curled skinny form of the adopted daughter, lying perfectly still in the next bed in the dark, pretending to sleep, silent, shell-breathing, with her hard, skinny, wounded, pre-addiction face turned to the wall, in the room's next bed, her bed, the one without the collapsible crib-like hospital railings along the sides. The audience is clutching its collective head, by this time only partly in empathy, as the speaker specifies how she was de facto emotionally all but like forced to flee and strip and swan dive into the dark spiritual anesthesia of active drug addiction in a dysfunctional attempt to psychologically deal with one particular seminally scarring night of abject horror. The indescribable horror of the way it, the biological daughter, had looked up at her, the speaker, one particular final time on this one particular one of the frequent occasions The speaker had to get out of bed after the father had come and gone, and tiptoe over to its bed and lean over the cold metal hospital railing and remove the rubber Raquel Welch mask and replace it in a bedside drawer under some back issues of Ramparts and Commonweal. After carefully closing its splayed legs and pulling down its variously stained designer nightie, all of which she made sure to do when the father didn't bother to at night, so that the wacko foster mother wouldn't come in the a.m. and find it in a rubber Raquel Welch mask with its nightie hiked up and its legs agape, and put two and two together and get all kinds of deep denial shattered about why the foster father always went around the foster house with a silent, creepy smile, and flip out and make the invertebrate catatonics father stop diddling it. Because, the speaker figured, if the foster father had to stop diddling it, it didn't exactly take Sally Jesse Raphael, M.S.W., to figure out who was then probably going to get promoted to the role of Raquel over in the next bed. The silent, smiling claims processor father never once acknowledged the adopted daughter's little post-incestuous tidyings up. It's the kind of sick, unspoken complicity, characteristic of wildly dysfunctional families, confides the speaker, who's also proud, she says, to be a member of a splinter 12-step fellowship, an adult child type thing called Wounded, Hurting, Inadequately Nurtured, but Ever Recovering Survivors. But so, she says, it was this one particular night soon after she turned 16, after the father had come and gone and uncaringly just left its mask on again, and over to its bedside the speaker had to creep in the dark, to tidy up. But this time it turned out there was a problem with the Raquel Welch mask's long auburn horsehair tresses having gotten twisted and knotted into the semi-living strands of its own elaborately overmoosed coiffure. And the adopted daughter had to activate the perimeter of lights on its bedside table's many-bubbled vanity mirror to see, to try to get the Raquel Welch wig untangled. And when she finally got the mask off, with the vanity mirror still blazing away, the speaker says how she was forced to gaze for the first time on its lit-up, paralytic, post-diddle face, and how the expression thereon was most assuredly quite enough to force anybody with an operant limbic system
142
to leg it right out of her dysfunctional foster family's home. Nay, and the whole community of Saugus, Massachusetts, now homeless and scared and forced by dark psychic forces straight to Route One's infamous gauntlet of neon light depravity and addiction to try and forget, Raza the tabula, wipe the memory totally out, numb it with opiates. Voice trembling, she accepts the chairperson's proffered bandana hanky and blows her nose one nostril at a time and says she can almost see it all over again, its expression. In the vanity's lights, only its eyes' whites showed, and while its utter catatonia and paralysis prevented the contraction of its luridly rouged face's circummoral muscles into any conventional human facial-type expression, nevertheless, some hideously mobile and expressive layer in the moist regions below real people's expressive facial layer, some slow twitch layer unique to it, had blindly contracted somehow to gather the blank, soft cheese of its face into the sort of pinched, gasping look of neurologic concentration that marks a carnal bliss beyond smiles or sighs. Its face looked post-coital, sort of the way you'd imagine the vacuole and optica of a protozoan-looking post-coital after it's shuttered and shot its monocellular load into the cold waters of some really old sea. Its facial expression was, in a word, the speaker says, unspeakably, unforgettably ghastly and horrid and scarring. It was also the exact same expression as the facial expression on the stone-robed lady's face in this one untitled photo of some Catholic statue that hung, the photo, in the dysfunctional household's parlor right above the little teak table where the dysfunctional foster mother kept her beads and hours and lay breviary. This photo of a statue of a woman whose stone robes were half hiked up and wrinkled in the most god-awfully, sensually, prurient way. The woman reclined against uncut rock, her robes hiked and one stone foot hanging off the rock as her legs hung parted. With a grinning little, totally psychotic-looking cherub-type angel, standing on the lady's open thighs and pointing a bare arrow at where the stone robe hit her cold tit. The woman's face upturned and cocked and pinched into that exact same shuddering, protozoan look beyond pleasure or pain. The wacko foster mom knelt daily to that photo, in a beaded and worshipful posture, and also required daily that it be hoisted by the adopted daughter from its never-mentioned wheelchair, and held under its arms, and lowered so as to approximate the same knelt devotion to the picture. And while it gurgled and its head lolled, the speaker had gazed at the photo with a nameless revulsion each morning, as she held its dead slumped weight and tried to keep its chin off its chest, and now was being forced into seeing by mirror light the exact same expression on the face of a catatonic who'd just been incestuously diddled, an expression at once reverent and greedy on a face connected by dead hair to the slack and flapping rubber visage of an old sex goddess's empty face. And, to make a long story short, the speaker says, not trying to be funny as far as the flaggers can see, the traumatically scarred adopted daughter had legged it from the bedroom and foster home into the brooding North Shore teen runaway night, and had stripped and semi-whored and IV-injected her way all the way to that standard two-option addicted cliff edge, hoping only to forget. That's what caused it, she says. That's what she's trying to recover from, a day at a time. And she's sure grateful to be here with her group today, sober and courageously remembering, and newcomers should definitely keep coming. As she's telling what she sees as etiological truth, even though the monologue seems sincere and unaffected, and at least a B-plus on the overall AA story lucidity scale, faces in the hall are averted and hands clutched and postures uneasily shifted in empathetic distress at the look-what-happened-to-poor-me invitation implicit in the tale, the talk's tone of self-pity itself less offensive, even though plenty of these white flaggers, Gately knows, had personal childhoods that made this girl's look like a day at Six Flags Over the Poconos. Then the subcurrent of explanation, an appeal to exterior cause that can slide in the addictive mind so insidiously into excuse that any causal attribution is, in Boston AA, feared, shunned, punished by empathetic distress. The why of the disease is a labyrinth. It is so strongly suggested all AA's boycott. Inhabited, as the maze is, by the twin minotaurs of why me and why not, also known as self-pity and denial. Two of the smiley-faced sergeant-at-arms, more fearsome aides-de-camp. The Boston AA in here that protects against a return to out there is not about explaining what caused your disease. It's about a goofily simple practical recipe for how to remember you've got the disease day by day and how to treat the disease day by day. How to keep the seductive ghost of a bliss long absconded from baiting you and hooking you and pulling you back out and eating your heart raw and, if you're lucky, eliminating your map for good. So, no whys or wherefores allowed. In other words, check your head at the door. Though it can't be conventionally enforced, this Boston AA's real root axiom is almost classically authoritarian, maybe even proto-fascist. Some ironist who decamped back out there and left his meager effects to be bagged and tossed by staff into the Ennett House addict had, all the way back in the year of the Tuck's medicated pad, permanently engraved his tribute to AA's real prime directive with a rosewood-handled boot knife in the plastic seat of the five-man men's room's commode. Do not ask why if you don't want to die. Do like you're told if you want to get old.
143.
The 30th of April to the 1st of May, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. The choreography of Interface had settled into the form of steeply smoking, his bare arms crossed, going up and down slowly on the toes of his high heels, while Marat hunched slightly in his metal chair, shoulders rounded and head slightly forward in a practiced position that allowed him almost to sleep while still attending to every detail of a conversation or wearisome surveillance. He, Marat, had drawn his plaid blanket up to his chest. It was increasingly chilly at the altitude of the shelf. They could feel the remains of the USA Sonora Desert's heat rising past them into the clotted spangle of stars that were above them. The shirt Marat wore beneath his windbreaker was not of Hawaiian type. Marat remained unsure in this time of what exactly it was that Hugh Steeply of USOUS wished to learn from him or verify through Marat's betrayal. Near midnight, Steeply had given him the datum that he, Steeply, had been on the personal marital leave over his recent divorce, and was now back in the field of duty, wearing prosthetic breasts and woman journalist credentials, assigned to cultivate some of the entertainment's alleged filmmakers' relatives and inner circles. Marat had made gentle fun of the inoriginality of a journalistic cover, then later less gentle fun of Steeply's cover's false name, expressing humored doubts that the meaty, electrolysized face of Steeply would be responsible for launching even one ship or vessel. There'd been that first brutal winter night, early in the ONANite, temporo-subsidized era, soon after the interlaced dissemination of the man who began to suspect he was made of glass, that himself emerged from the sauna and came to Lyle all sloppy blotto and depressed over the fact that even the bastards in the avant-garde journals were complaining that even in his commercially entertaining stuff, Incandenza's fatal Achilles heel was plot. That Incandenza's efforts had no sort of engaging plot, no movement that sucked you in and drew you along.
144.
Mario and Ms. Joelle Van Dyne are probably the only people who know that found drama,
145,
and anti-confluentialism both came out of this night with Lyle. It's not like Boston AA recoils from the idea of responsibility, though. Cause, no. Responsibility, yes. It seems like it all depends on which way the arrow of presumed responsibility points. The hard-faced adopted stripper had presented herself as the object of an outside cause. Now the arrow comes back around as tonight's meeting's last and maybe best advanced basic speaker, another newcomer, a round pink girl with no eyelashes at all, and a base head's ruined teeth, gets up there and speaks in an R-less South Boston brogue about being pregnant at 20 and smoking 8 balls of freebase cocaine like a fiend all through her pregnancy, even though she knew it was bad for the baby and wanted desperately to quit. She tells about having her water break and contractions start late one night in her welfare hotel room when she was right in the middle of an 8-ball. She'd had to spend the evening turning unbelievably sordid and degrading tricks to pay for. She did what she had to do to get high, she says, even while pregnant, she says. And she says even when the pain of the contractions got to be too bad to bear, she'd been unable to tear herself away from the base pipe to go to the free clinic to deliver. And how she'd sat on the floor of the welfare hotel room and free-based her way all through labor. That new Joelle girl's veils billowing in and out with her breath, Gately sees, just like it also was during the last speaker's description of the statue's orgasm in the catatonic's dysfunctional Catholic mother's devotional photo, and how she'd finally delivered of a stillborn infant, right there, alone on her side like a cow on the rug of her room, all the time throughout still compulsively loading up the glass pipe and smoking, and how the infant emerged all dry and hard, like a constipated turdlet, with no protective moisture and no afterbirth material following it out. And how the emerged infant was tiny and dry and all withered in the color of strong tea and dead, and also had no face. Had in utero, developed no eyes or nostrils, and just a little lipless hyphen of a mouth. And its limbs were malformed and arachnodactylic. And there had been some sort of translucent reptilian-like webbing between its mucronate digits. The speaker's mouth is a quivering arch of woe. Her baby had been poisoned before it could grow a face or make any personal choices. It would have soon died of substance withdrawal in the free clinic's Pyrex incubator if it had emerged alive anyway, she could tell. She'd been on such a bad base binge all that pregnant year. But so eventually the eight ball was consumed, and then the screen and steel wool ball in the pipe itself smoked, and the cloth prep filter smoked to ash, and then, of course, likely looking pieces of lint had been gleaned off the rug and also smoked. And the girl finally passed out, still umbilically linked to the dead infant. And how when she came to again in unsparing noonlight the next day and saw what still clung by a withered cord to her empty insides, she got introduced to the real business end of the arrow of responsibility. And as she gazed in daylight at the withered, faceless, stillborn baby, she was so overcome with grief and self-loathing that she erected a fortification of complete and black denial, like total denial. She held and swaddled the dead thing just as if it were alive instead of dead, and she began to carry it around with her wherever she went, just as she imagined devoted mothers carry their babies with them everywhere they go, the faceless infant's corpse, completely veiled and hidden in a little pink blanket the addicted expectant mother'd let herself buy at Woolworth's at 7 months. And she also kept the cord's connection intact until her end of the cord finally fell out of her and dangled and smelled. And she carried the dead infant everywhere, even when turning sordid tricks. Because single motherhood or not, she still needed to get high, and still had to do what she had to do to get high. So she carried the blanket-wrapped infant in her arms as she walked the streets in her velvet fuchsia mini-pants and halter top and green spike heels, turning tricks. Until there began to be strong evidence, as she circled her block, it was August. Let's just say compelling evidence, that the infant in the stained cocoon of blanket in her arms was not a biologically viable infant. And passers-by on the South Boston streets began to reel away, white-faced, as the girl passed by,
stretch-marked and brown-toothed and lashless.
Lashes lost in a substance accident. Fire hazard and dental dysplasia go with the freebase terrain. And also just hauntedly calm-looking, oblivious to the olfactory havoc she was wreaking in the sweltering streets. But her August's trick business soon fell off sharply, understandably. And eventually word that there was a serious infant and denial problem here got around the streets. And her fellow Southie baseheads and street friends came to her with not ungentle R-less remonstrances and scented hankies, and gently prying hands, and tried to reason her out of her denial. But she ignored them all. She guarded her infant from all harm, and kept it clutched to her. It was by now sort of stuck to her, and would have been hard to separate from her by hand anyway. And she'd walk the streets, shunned and trickless and broke, and in early stage substance withdrawal. With the remains of the dead infant's tummy's cord dangling out from an unclosable fold in the now ominously ballooned and crusty Woolworth's blanket. Talk about denial. This girl was in some major league denial. But finally a pale and reeling beat cop phoned an hysterical olfactory alert in to the Commonwealth's infamous Department of Social Services. Gately sees alcoholic moms all over the hall cross themselves and shudder at the mere mention of DSS. Every addicted parent's worst nightmare, DSS. They, of the several different abstruse legal definitions of neglect, and the tungsten-tipped battering ram for triple-locked apartment doors. In a dark window, Gately sees one reflected mom sitting over with the Brighton AAs that has her two little girls with her in the meeting, and now at the DSS reference, clutches them reflexively to her bosom, one head per bosom. As one of the girls struggles and dips her knees in the little curtsies of impending potty. But so now DSS was on the case, and a platoon of blandly efficient, Wellesley alum DSS field personnel with clipboards and scary black Chanel women's business wear were now on the prowl in the South Boston streets for the addicted speaker and her late faceless infant. And but finally, around this time, during the last year's awful late August heat wave, evidence that the infant had a serious bioviability problem started presenting itself so forcefully that even the denial-ridden addict in the mother could not ignore or dismiss it. Evidence which the speaker's reticence about describing, save to say that it involved an insect attraction problem, makes things all the worse for the empathetic white flaggers, since it engages the dark imaginations all substance abusers share in surplus. And so, but the mother says how she finally broke down, emotionally and olfactorily, from the overwhelming evidence on the cement playground outside her own late mother's abandoned project building off the L Street beach in Southie. And a DSS field team closed in for the pinch, and she and her infant got pinched. And special DSS spray solvents had to be sent for and utilized in order to detach the Woolworth baby blanket from her maternal bosom. And the blanket's contents were more or less reassembled and were interred in a DSS coffin the speaker recalls as being the size of a Mary Kay makeup case. And the speaker was medically informed by somebody with a clipboard from DSS that the infant had been involuntarily toxified to death somewhere along in its development toward becoming a boy. And the mother, after a painful D&C for the impacted placenta she'd carried inside, then spent the next 4 months on the locked ward of Metropolitan State Hospital in Waltham, Massachusetts, psychotic with denial, deferred guilt, and cocaine withdrawal, and searing self-hatred. And how, when she finally got discharged from Met State with her first SSI mental disability check, she found she had no taste for chunks or powders. She wanted only tall, smooth bottles whose labels spoke of proof. And she drank and drank and believed in her heart she would never stop or swallow the truth. But finally she got to where she had to, she says, swallow it, the responsible truth. How she quickly drank her way to the old two-option welfare hotel window ledge and made a blubbering 0200 hours phone call. And then so, here she is, apologizing for going on so long, trying to tell a truth she hopes someday to swallow inside, so she can just try and live. When she concludes by asking them to pray for her, it almost doesn't sound corny. Gately tries not to think. Here is no cause or excuse. It is simply what happened. This final speaker is truly new, ready. All defenses have been burned away. Smooth-skinned and steadily pinker at the podium. Her eyes squeezed tight, she looks like she's the one that's the infant. The host white flaggers pay this burnt public husk of a newcomer the ultimate Boston AA compliment. They have to consciously try to remember even to blink as they watch her, listening, IDing without effort. There's no judgment. It's clear she's been punished enough. And it was basically the same all over, after all, out there. And the fact that it was so good to hear her, so good that even Tiny Ewell and Kate Gompert and the rest of the worst of them all sat still and listened without blinking, looking not just at the speaker's face but into it, helps force Gately to remember all over again what a tragic adventure this is that none of them signed up for. They'd been the odd couple of libations, the muscled fitness guru and the tall, slope-shouldered optician director, often down there in the weight room till all hours, sitting on the towel dispenser, drinking. Lyle with his caffeine-free Diet Coke, in Cadenza with his wild turkey. Mario literally standing by in case the ice bucket ran out, or himself needed moral support getting to the urinal. Mario often fell asleep as the hour got severe, drifted in and out, slept upright and leaning forward, weight borne by his police lock and lead receptacle. James Incandenza was one of those profound personality change drinkers who seemed quiet and centered and almost affectless when he was sober, but would move way out to one side or the other of the human emotional spectrum when drunk, and seem to open up in a way that was almost injudicious. Sometimes, libated late at night with Lyle in the newly outfitted ETA weight room, and Candenza'd open up and pour his heart's thickest chyme right out there for all to be affected and potentially scarred by. For example, one night Mario, leaning way forward in the police lock support, drifted awake to the sound of his father saying that if he had to grade his marriage, he'd give it a C-. This seems injudicious in the extreme, potentially, though Mario, like Lyle, tends to take data pretty much as it comes. Lyle, who sometimes would start to get tipsy himself, as himself's pores began to excrete the bourbon, often brought some Blake out, as in William Blake, during these all-night sessions, and read Incandenza Blake, but in the voices of various cartoon characters, which himself eventually started regarding as deep.
146.
The 8th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Gaudiamus igitur. If it's odd that Mario Incandenza's first halfway coherent film cartridge, a 48-minute job shot 3 summers back in the carefully decorated janitor closet of Subdorm B, with his head mount Bolex H-64 and foot treadle. If it's odd that Mario's first finished entertainment consists of a film of a puppet show, like a kid's puppet show, then it probably seems even odder that the film's proven to be way more popular with ETA's adults and adolescents than it is with the woefully, historically, underinformed children it had first been made for. It's proved so popular that it gets shown annually now every 11/8, Continental Interdependence Day, on a wide-beam cartridge projector and stand-up screen in the ETA dining hall after supper. It's part of the gala, but rather ironic, annual celebration of Interdependence Day at an academy whose founder had married a Canadian, and it usually gets underway about 19:30 hours, the film, and everybody gathers in the dining hall and watches it. And by Charles Tavis's festive fiat,
147,
everybody gets to two-handed snack instead of squeezing tennis balls while they watch. And not only that, but normal ETA dietary regulations are, for an hour, completely suspended. And Mrs. Clark, the dietitian out in the kitchen, a former 4-star dessert chef normally relegated here to protein conveyors and ways to very complex carbs, Mrs. Clark gets to put on her floppy white chef's hat and just go Socratically mad out in Westhouse's gleaming kitchen. Everybody's supposed to wear some sort of hat. Avril Incandenza positively towers in the same steeple-crowned witch's hat she teaches all her classes in every 10:31. And Pemulus wears the complex yachting cap and naval braid. And Pale and Blotchy Struck a toque with a kind of flitty aigrette. And Hal a black preacher's hat with a stern, round, downturned brim, etc., etc.
148.
And Mario, as director and putative author of the popular film, is encouraged to say a few words, like, 8.
Thanks, everybody, and I hope you like it, is what he said this year,
with Pemulus behind him making a show of putting a maraschino on top of the small twizzle of Ready Whip that O. Stice had sprayed on the top of Mario's head-mounted Bolex H-64, which counts as a hat. When the dessert course's zenith had gotten slightly out of control near the Interdependence Day gala supper's end. These few brief words and round of applause are Mario's big public yearly moment at ETA, and he neither likes the moment nor dislikes it. Same with the untitled film itself, which really started out as just a kid's adaptation of the O.N.A.N. Tired, a 4-hour piece of tendentiously anti-confluential political parody, long since dismissed as minor Incandenza by his late father's archivists. Mario's piece isn't really better than his father's. It's just different. Plus, of course, way shorter. It's pretty obvious that somebody else in the Incandenza family had at least an Emanuenic hand in the screenplay. But Mario did the choreography and most of the puppet work personally. His little S-shaped arms and falcate digits are perfect for the forward curve from body to snout of a standard big-headed political puppet. And it was, without question, Mario's little square hush puppy on the H-64's operant foot treadle, the Bolux itself mounted on one of the tunnel's locked labs, Husky 6TL tripods, across the overlit closet, mops and dull gray janitorial buckets carefully moved out past the frame's borders on either side of the little velvet stage. Anne Kittenplan and two older crew-cut girls sit in identical snap-brim fedoras with their arms crossed. Kittenplan's right hand bandaged. Mary Esther Thode is grading midterms on the sly. Rick Dunkel has his eyes closed but is not asleep. Somebody slapped an ad hoc Red Sox cap on the visiting Syrian Satellite Pro, and the Syrian Satellite Pro sits with most of the pro-rectors, looking confused, his shoulder taped up with a heatable compress, being polite about the comparative authenticity of Mrs. C.'s baklava. Everyone gathers and all's quiet except for the sounds of saliva and chewing, and there's the yeasty sweet smell of Coach Stitt's pipe, and ETA's youngest kid, Tina Echt, in her giant beret, gets to be in charge of the lights. Mario's thing opens without credits, just a crudely matted imposition of fake linotype print, a quotation from President Gentle's second inaugural. Let the call go forth to pretty much any nation we might feel like calling, that the past has been torched by a new and millennial generation of Americans, against a full facial still photo of a truly unmistakable personage. This is the projected face of Johnny Gentle, famous crooner. This is Johnny Gentle, formerly Joyner, lounge singer turned teeny bopper throb turned B-movie mainstay, for two long past decades known unkindly as the cleanest man in entertainment. The man's a world-class retentive, the late Howard Hughes kind, the really severe kind, the kind with the paralyzing fear of free-floating contamination. The either wear a surgical microfiltration mask or make the people around you wear surgical caps and masks and touch doorknobs only with a boiled hanky and take 14 showers a day, only they're not exactly showers. They're with this Dermalatex brand shower-sized hypospectral flash booth that actually, like, burns your outermost layer of skin off in a dazzling flash and leaves you baby's butt new and sterile once you wipe off the coating of fine epidermal lash with a boiled hanky kind. Then in later public life, a sterile toupee-wearing promoter, an entertainment union bigwig, Vegas schmaltz broker, and head of the infamous Velvety Vocalists Guild, the tanned, gold-chained labor union that enforced those 7 months of infamously dreadful live silence.
149.
The total scab-free solidarity and performative silence that struck floor shows and sound stages from desert to New Jersey coast for over half a year until equitable compensation formulae on certain late millennial phone order retrospective TV advertised so you don't forget order before midnight tonight type records and CDs were agreed on by management. Hence, then, Johnny Gentle, the man who brought GERCA to heel, and then thus, at the millennial fulcrum of very dark U.S. times, to national politics. The facial stills that Mario lap dissolves between are of Johnny Gentle, famous crooner, founding standard-bearer of the seminal new Clean U.S. Party, the strange-seeming but politically prescient annular agnation of ultra-right jingoist hunt-deer-with-automatic-weapons types, and far-left macrobiotic save-the-ozone-rainforests whales, spotted owl and high-pH waterways, ponytailed granola crunchers, a surreal union of both Rush Limbaugh and Hillary Rodham Clinton, disillusioned fringes that drew mainstream media guffaws at their first convention, held in sterile venue, a seemingly lauriciously marginal party whose first platform's plank had been, "Let's shoot our wastes into space."
150.
The Clean U.S. Party, known as CUSP, a kind of post-Perot national joke for 3 years, until, white-gloved finger on the pulse of an increasingly asthmatic and sunscreen-slathered and pissed-off American electorate, the CUSP suddenly swept to quadrennial victory in an angry reactionary voter spasm that made the UWSA and LaRouchers and Libertarians chew their hands in envy as the Dems and GOPs stood on either side watching dumbly, like doubles partners who each think the others surely got it. The two established mainstream parties split open along tired philosophical lines in a dark time when all landfills got full and all grapes were raisins, and sometimes, in some places, the falling rain clunked instead of splatted, and also, recall, a post-Soviet and jihad era when, somehow even worse, there was no real foreign menace of any real unified potency to hate and fear. And the U.S. sort of turned in on itself in its own philosophical fatigue and hideous redolent wastes with a spasm of panicked rage that in retrospect seems possible only in a time of geopolitical supremacy and consequent silence, the loss of any external menace to hate and fear. This motionless face on the ETA screen is Johnny Gentle, third-party stunner. Johnny Gentle, the first U.S. president ever to swing his microphone around by the cord during his inauguration speech, whose new white-suited Office of Unspecified Services retinue required inauguration attendees to scrub and mask and then walk through chlorinated footbaths as at public pools. Johnny Gentle, managing somehow to look presidential in a Fukuyama microfiltration mask, whose inaugural address heralded the advent of a tighter, tidier nation, who promised to clean up government and trim fat and sweep out waste and hose down our chemically troubled streets and to sleep darn little until he'd fashioned a way to rid the American psychosphere of the unpleasant debris of a throwaway past, to restore the majestic ambers and purple fruits of a culture he now promises to rid of the toxic effluvia choking our highways and littering our byways and grunging up our sunsets and cruddying those harbors in which televised garbage barges lay stacked up at anchor, clotted and impotent amid undulating clouds of pot-bellied gulls and those disgusting blue-bodied flies that live on shit. First U.S. president ever to say shit publicly, shuddering. Rusty-hulled barges cruising up and down petroleated coastlines are laying up, reeking and stacked and emitting CO as they await the opening of new landfills and toxic repositories the people demanded in every area but their own. The Johnny Gentle whose CUSP had been totally upfront about seeing American renewal as an essentially aesthetic affair. The Johnny Gentle who promised to be the possibly sometimes unpopular architect of a more or less spotless America that cleaned up its own side of the street, of a new arid nation that looked out for Uno, of a one-time world policeman that was now going to retire and have its blue uniform deep dry-cleaned and placed in storage in triple-thick plastic dry-cleaning bags and hang up its cuffs to spend some quality domestic time raking its lawn and cleaning behind its refrigerator and dandling its freshly bathed kids on its neatly pressed, mufti-pants knee. A Gentle behind whom a diorama of the Lincoln Memorial's Lincoln smiled down benignly. A Johnny Gentle who was, as of this new minute, sending forth the call that he wasn't in this for a popularity contest.
Popsicle stick and felt puppets in the address's audience, assuming puzzled-looking expressions above their tiny green surgical masks.
A President Johnny Gentle, F.C., who said he wasn't going to stand here and ask us to make some tough choices, because he was standing here promising he was going to make them for us, who asked us simply to sit back and enjoy the show. who handled wild applause from camouflage, fatigue, and sandal and poncho-clad cusps with the unabashed grace of a real pro, who had black hair and silver sideburns, just like his big-headed puppet, and the dusty brick-colored tan seen only among those without homes, and those whose homes had a dermalatex hypospectral personal sterilization booth, who declared that neither tax and spend nor cut and borrow comprised the ticket into a whole new millennial era. Here more puzzlement among the inaugural audience, which Mario represents by having the tiny-fingered puppets turn rigidly toward each other, and then away, and then toward. Who alluded to ripe and available novel sources of revenue just waiting out there, unexploited, not seen by his predecessors because of the trees? Who foresaw budgetary adipose, trimmed with a really big knife? The Johnny Gentle who stressed above all, simultaneously pleaded for and promised, an end to atomized Americans' fractious blaming of one another for our terrible internal troubles.
151.
Here bobs and smiles from both wealthily green-masked puppets and homeless puppets in rags and mismatched shoes and with used surgical masks, all made by ETA's fourth and fifth grade crafts class under the supervision of Ms. Heath, of matchsticks and popsicle stick shards and pool table felt with sequins for eyes and painted fingernail pairings for smiles or frowns under their masks. The Johnny Gentle, chief executive who pounds a rubber-gloved fist on the podium so hard it knocks the seal askew and declares that, damn it, there must be some people besides each other of us to blame, to unite in opposition to. And he promises to eat light and sleep very little until he finds them, in the Ukraine, or the Teutons, or the wacko Latins, or, pausing with that one arm up and head down in the climactic Vegas way, closer to right below our noses, he swears he'll find us some cohesion-renewing other, and then make some tough choices. Alludes to a whole new North America for a crazy post-millennial world. First U.S. president ever to use boss as an adjective. His throwing the surgical gloves into the miniature inaugural crowd as souvenirs is Mario's own touch. And Mario Incandenza's idea of representing President Gentle's cabinet is made up mostly of tall, coiffured black girl puppets and shiny imbricate sequin dresses is also, of course, historically inaccurate, though the honorary inclusion in that cabinet's second year of the Presidente of Mexico and the Prime Minister of Canada is both factual and, of course, seminal. The President of Mexico and Prime Minister of Canada, in unison and green mask muffled.
It is tremendously flattering to be invited to sit on the cabinet of the leadership of our beloved neighbor to the...
Choose one. Gentle.
Thanks, boys. You have gorgeous souls.
It's not the cartridge's strongest scene, heavy on stock phrases and two-handed handshakes. But the historical fact that the Presidente of Mexico and Prime Minister of Canada are honorarily appointed by President Gentle to be secretaries of Mexico and Canada, respectively, as if the neighbors had already become sort of post-millennial American protectorates, is foreshadowed as ominous by a wavering D minor on the soundtrack's organ. Mrs. Clark's Wurlitzer at home. But the two leaders' respectively dusky and Gallic expressions seem unperturbed under their green masks as more stock phrases are invoked. Because budget and broom closet constraints make artful transitions between scenes impractical, Mario has opted for the inter-scenic entre-act device of having Johnny Gentle, famous crooner, doing some of his repertoire's bouncier numbers, with the cabinet members undulating and harmonizing Motownishly behind him, and other puppets bouncing in tempo on and off stage as the script requires. Audience-wise, most of the ETA's under 12, Cortex's spangling with once-a-year suites, have by now emigrated hyperactively under the long table's tablecloths and met up on the dining hall floor below and begun navigating on hands and knees the special children's second world of shins and chair legs and tile that exists under long tablecloths, making various sorts of puerile trouble. Investigations from last year's Interdependence Day are still in progress, wrought which kid or kids tied Aubrey Dillon's shoelaces together and crazy-glued Mary Esther Thode's left buttock to the seat of her chair. But everyone glycemically mature enough to sit still and watch the cartridge is having a rousing good time, eating chocolate, cannolis, and 26-layer baklava, and Ready Whip by itself if they want, and homemade raisinettes, and little cream-filled caramel things, and occasionally heckling or cheering ironically. Every so often throwing sweets that stick to the screen, giving the smooth, sterile, gentle, a sort of carbuncular look that everyone approves. There is much cracking wise and baritone mimicry of a president roundly disliked for over 2 terms now. Only John Wayne and a handful of other Canadian students sit, unhatted, chewing stolidly, faces blurred and distant. This American penchant for absolution via irony is foreign to them. The Canadian boys remember only hard facts, and the glass-walled great convexity, whose southern array of ATH SCME effectuators blow the tidy U.S.'s northern oxides north toward home. And they feel with special poignancy, on 11-8, the implications of their being down here, south of the border, training, in the land of their enemy ally. And the less gifted among them wonder whether they'll ever get to go home again after graduation, if a pro-career or scholarship doesn't pan out. Wayne has a cloth hanky and keeps wiping his nose. Mario's openly jejune version of his late father's take on the rise of ONAN and U.S. imperialism unfolds in little diffracted bits of real news and fake news and privately conceived dialogue between the architects and hard choice makers of a new millennial era. Gentle.
Another piece of pre-tasted cobbler, JJJC?
Prime Minister of Canada.
Couldn't. Stuffed.
Having trouble breathing. I would not say no to another beer, however. Gentle. Prime Minister of Canada. Gentle.
So we're simpatico on the gradual and subtle but inexorable disarmament and dissolution of NATO as a system of mutual defense agreements.
Prime Minister of Canada. Less muffled than last seen because his surgical mask gets to have a prandial hole. We are side by side and behind you on this thing. Let the EEC pay for their own defendings, henceforth, I say. Let them foot some defensive budgets and then try to subsidize their farmers into undercutting NAFTA. Let them eat butter and guns for their own for once in a change, eh?
Gentle. You said more than a mouthful right there, JJ. Now maybe we can all direct some cool-headed attention to our own infraternal affairs. Our own internal quality of life. Refocusing priorities back to this crazy continent we call home. Am I being Doug?
Prime Minister of Canada. John, I am kilometers ahead of you. I happen to have my term in office at a glance book right here with me. Now that the big frappeurs are being put down, we are wondering, what is the date I can be penciling in for the removals of NATO ICBM frappeurs from Manitoba?
Gentle. Put that pencil away, you good-looking Canadian. I've got more long, shiny trailer rigs full of large men with very short haircuts and white suits than you can shake a maple leaf at, heading for your silos right this very. Those complete totalities of Canada's strategic capacity will be out of your hair toot sweet.
Prime Minister of Canada. John, let me be the first world leader to call you a statesman.
Gentle. We North Americans have to stick together, JJJC, especially now, no? Am I off base? We're interdependent. We're cheek to jowl.
Prime Minister of Canada. It is a smaller world today.
Gentle. And an even smaller continent.
This segues into an entr'acte, with continent squeezed in for world in It's a Small World After All, which in jammed doesn't do the rhythm section of doo-wopping Cabinet Girls a bit of good, but does usher in the start of a whole new era. Though, can any guru be held to a standard of like 100% exemption from the human pains of stunted desire? No. Not 100%. Regardless of level of transcendence or diet. Lyle, down in the dark, interdependent stay weight room, sometimes recalls an ETA player from several years back, whose first name was Marlin, and whose last name Lyle never, to his knowledge, learned.
152.
The thing about this Marlin was that he was always wet. Arms purling, t-shirt darkly V'd, face and forehead ever gleaming. Oren's Academy doubles partner. It had had a lemony, locale taste, the boy's omni-wetness. It wasn't exactly sweat because you could lick off the forehead and more beads instantly replace what you'd taken. None of real sweat's frustratingly gradual accretion. The boy was always in the shower, always doing his best to stay clean. There were powders and pills and electrical appliques. And still this Marlin dripped and shone. The kid wrote accomplished juvenile verses about the dry, clean boy inside, struggling to break the soggy surface. He shared extensively with Lyle. He confessed to Lyle one night in the quiet weight room that he'd gone in for high-level athletics mostly to have an excuse of some sort for being as wet as he was. It always looked like Marlin had been rained on. But it wasn't rain. It's like Marlin hadn't been dry since the womb. It's like he leaked. It had been a tormenting but also in certain ways halcyon few years in the past. A tormentingly unspecific hope in the air. Lyle had told this boy everything he had to tell. It's raining tonight, though. As so often happens in autumn below the great concavity, PM snow has given way to rain. Outside the weight room's high windows, a mean wind sweeps curtains of rain this way and that, and the windows shudder and drool. The sky is a mess. Thunder and lightning happen at the same time. The copper beach outside creaks and groans. Lightning claws the sky, briefly illuminating Lyle, seated, lotus, in spandex on the towel dispenser, leaning forward to accept what is offered in the dark weight room. The idle resistance machines look insectile in the lightning's brief light. The answer to some of the newer kids' complaints about what on earth Lyle can be doing down there at night in a locked, empty weight room is that the nighttime weight room is rarely empty. The PM custodians, Kenkel and Brandt, do lock it up, but the door can be dickied by even the clumsiest insertion of an ETA meal card between latch and jamb. The kitchen crew always wonders why so many meal cards' edges always look ravaged. Though the idle machines are scary, and the room smells somehow worse in the dark, they come most at night, the ETAs, who are on to Lyle. They hit the saunas out by the cement stairs until they've got enough incentive on their skin. Then they lurk, pearled and shiny, in towels by the weight room door, waiting to enter one by one, sometimes several ETAs dripping in towels, not speaking, some pretending to have other business down there. Lurking in the eye-averted attitudes of, like, patients in the waiting room of an impotence clinic, or shrink. They have to be real quiet, and the lights stay off. It's like the administration will turn a blind eye as long as you make it plausible to do so. From the dining hall, whose east wall of windows faces calm ad, you can hear very muffled laughter and kibitzing and the occasional scream from Mario's interdependent puppet thing. A quiet, slow, small stream of yellow-slickered, wet-shoed migrations back and forth between West House and the weight room. People know the slow parts, the times to duck out, and go very briefly down to Lyle to confer. They dicky the lock and go in one by one, in towels. Proffer beaded flesh. Confront the sort of issues reserved for nighttime's garudical tete-a-tete. Whispers made echoless by rubberized floors and much damp laundry. Sometimes Lyle will listen and shrug and smile and say, "The world is very old," or some such general remark, and decline to say much else. But it's the way he listens, somehow, that keeps the saunas full. Lightning claws the eastern sky, and it's neat in the weight room's dark because Lyle is in a slightly different position and forward angle each time he's illuminated through the window up over the grip-slash-wrist-slash-forearm machines to his left. So it looks like there are different Lyles at different fulgurant moments. Lamont Chu, glabrous and high gloss and a white towel and wristwatch, haltingly confesses to an increasingly crippling obsession with tennis fame. He wants to get to the show so bad it feels like it's eating him alive. To have his picture in shiny magazines, to be a wunderkind, to have guys in blue ISPN blazers describe his every on-court move and mood in hushed broadcast cliches, to have little patches with products' names sewn onto his clothes, to be soft-profiled, to get compared to Monsieur Chang, lately expired, to get called the next great yellow U.S. hope. Let's not even talk about video magazines or the grid. He confesses it to Lyle. He wants the hype. He wants it. Sometimes he'll pretend a glowing up-at-net action shot he's clipping out of a shiny magazine is of him, Lamont Chu. But then he finds he can't eat or sleep or sometimes even pee. So horribly does he envy the adults in the show who get to have up-at-net action shots of themselves in magazines. Sometimes, he says, lately, he won't take risks in tournament matches even when risks are okay or even called for because he finds he's too scared of losing and hurting his chances for the show and hype and fame down the road. A couple times this year, the cold, clenched fear of losing has itself made him lose, he believes. He's starting to fear that rabid ambition has more than one blade, maybe. He's ashamed of his secret hunger for hype in an academy that regards hype and the seduction of hype as the great Mephistophelian pitfall and hazard of talent. A lot of these are his own terms. He feels himself in a dark world inside, ashamed, lost, locked in. Lamont Chu is 11 and hits with two hands off both sides. He doesn't mention the eschaton or having been punched in the stomach. The obsession with future tense fame makes all else pale. His wrists are so thin he wears his watch halfway up his forearm, which looks sort of gladiatorial. Lyle has a way of sucking on the insides of his cheeks as he listens. Plates of old rigid muscle emerge and subside as he shifts his weight slightly on the raised towel dispenser. The dispenser is at about shoulder height for someone like Chu. Like all good listeners, he has a way of attending that is at once intense and assuasive. The supplicant feels both nakedly revealed and sheltered somehow from all possible judgment. It's like he's working as hard as you. You both of you, briefly, feel unalone. Lyle will suck in first one side's cheek and then the other.
"You burn to have your photograph in a magazine."
"I'm afraid so."
"Why again, exactly now?"
"I guess to be felt about as I feel about those players with their pictures in magazines."
"Why?"
"Why? I guess to give my life some sort of kind of meaning, Lyle."
"And how would this do this again?"
"Lyle, I don't know. I don't know. It just does. It would. Why else would I burn like this, clip secret pictures, not take risks, not sleep or pee?"
"You feel these men with their photographs in magazines care deeply about having their photographs in magazines derive immense meaning?"
"I do. They must. I would. Else why would I burn like this to feel as they feel?
The meaning they feel, you mean. From the fame.
Lyle, don't they?
Lyle sucks his cheeks.
It's not like he's condescending or stringing you along. He's thinking as hard as you. It's like he's you in the top of a clean pond. It's part of the attention. One side of his cheeks almost caves in, thinking,
Lamont, perhaps they did at first. The first photograph, the first magazine, the gratified surge, the seeing themselves as others see them, the hagiography of image, perhaps. Perhaps the first time, enjoyment. After that, do you trust me? Trust me. They do not feel what you burn for. After the first surge, they care only that their photographs seem awkward, or unflattering, or untrue, or that their privacy, this thing you burn to escape, what they call their privacy, is being violated. Something changes. After the first photograph has been in a magazine, the famous men do not enjoy their photographs in magazines so much as they fear that their photographs will cease to appear in magazines. They are trapped, just as you are.
Is this supposed to be good news? This is awful news.
Lamont, are you willing to listen to a remark about what is true?
Okie dokie.
The truth will set you free, but not until it is finished with you.
Maybe I ought to be getting back.
Lamont, the world is very old. You have been snared by something untrue. You are deluded. But this is good news. You have been snared by the delusion that envy has a reciprocal. You assume that there is a flip side to your painful envy of Michael Chang, namely, Michael Chang's enjoyable feeling of being envied by Lamont Chu. No such animal.
Animal?
You burn with hunger for food that does not exist.
This is good news.
It is the truth. To be envied, admired, is not a feeling. Nor is fame a feeling. There are feelings associated with fame, but few of them are any more enjoyable than the feelings associated with envy of fame.
The burning doesn't go away?
What fire dies when you feed it? It is not fame itself they wish to deny you here. Trust them. There is much fear in fame. Terrible and heavy fear to be pulled and held, carried. Perhaps they want only to keep it off you until you weigh enough to pull it toward yourself.
Would I sound ungrateful if I said this doesn't make me feel very much better at all?
Lamont, the truth is that the world is incredibly, incredibly, unbelievably old. You suffer with the stunted desire caused by one of its oldest lies. Do not believe the photographs. Fame is not the exit from any cage.
So I'm stuck in the cage from either side. Fame or tortured envy of fame. There's no way out.
You might consider how escape from a cage must surely require,
foremost, awareness of the fact of the cage. And I believe I see a drop on your temple right there.
Etc. The thunders died down to a mutter, and the windows, spatters gone random, and post-storm sad. An ETA female. Female students wear two different towels coming in. A breastless senior who can barely perspire at all is troubled whenever she has lunch with her fiancé by the persistent whine of a mosquito that she can't see and no one else can hear. Summer and winter, indoors or al fresco, but only at lunch and only with her fiancé. Remarks or advice are not always the point. Sometimes suffering's point is almost crying out in a high-pitched whine to be heard. As fitness gurus go, Lyle is results-oriented and can-do.
153.
10-year-old Kent Blott, whose parents are Seventh-day Adventists, isn't yet old enough to masturbate, but he hears quite a lot about it, not surprisingly, from his adolescent peers, in rather lush detail, masturbation, and is worried about what sorts of homemade-type potentially wicked and soul-sapping pornographic cartridges will run through his psychic projector as he masturbates, when he eventually can masturbate, and worries about whether different sorts of fantasy scenes and combinations herald different sorts of psychic dysfunction or turpitude, and wants to get a good jump on worrying about it. The sounds of the dining hall's gala are more frequent and convulsive without the sound of rain. Lyle tells Blott not to let the weight he would pull to himself exceed his own personal weight. Up to the left, the storms, clouds, stragglers run like ink and water between the window and the risen moon. Mario Incandenza's presidential puppet is just about to inaugurate subsidized time. 16B's Anton Duchette's been driven to Lyle, he says, by an increasing self-consciousness about the big, round, dark, raised mole on his upper lip, just under his left nostril. It's only a mole, but looks pretty dire, nasally. People who first meet him are always pulling him off to the side and handing him a Kleenex. Duchette lately wishes either the mole were gone or he were gone. Even if people don't stare at the mole, it's like they're intentionally not staring at it. Duchette pounds himself on the chest and thigh, supposedly in frustration. He just cannot come to terms with how it must look. It's getting worse as puberty intensifies, the anxiety. Then, in a vicious cycle, the anxiety prompts a nervous tic on his face's right side. He's starting to suspect that some upperclassmen are referring to him behind his back as Anton Booger Duchette. It's like he's frozen on this anxiety, unable to move on to more advanced anxieties. He can't see any way past this. The pounding is more a sign of intense, unconscious self-hatred, though, Lyle knows. Duchette grimaces and says he's starting to want to play tennis with his hand over his nose and upper lip. But he has a two-handed backhand, and it's too late to switch, and there's no way they're going to let him switch to one hand just for aesthetic reasons. Lyle sends Anton Duchette packing off with directions to come back with Mario Incandenza the minute the Interdependence Day gala lets out. Mario gets a fair number of aesthetic self-consciousness referrals from Lyle. No type or rank of guru is above delegating. It's like a law. Duchette says it's like he's stuck. It's becoming all he thinks about. This on his way out. His back's additional moles form no outline or shape. Lyle pops the tab to a caffeine-free Diet Coke Mario tends to bring down most evenings around supper time. In between door dickyings and visits, Lyle does little isometric neck stretches for the tension. Between Gerhard Stitt's pipe and Avril Incandenza's Benson and Hedges, and certain cheeks full of chewing tobacco, plus the maddening cooking smells of honey and chocolate, and real high-lipid walnuts from the kitchen vents, plus over 150 very fit bodies, only some of which have been showered on this day off. The dining hall is warm and close and multi-odored. Mario, as auteur, opts for his late father's parodic device of mixing real and fake news summary cartridges, magazine articles, and historical headers from the last few great daily papers, all for a sort of time-lapse exposition of certain developments leading up to interdependence and subsidized time, and cartographic reconfiguration, and the renewal of a tight and considerably tidier experialist U.S. of A. under Gentile. Ukraine. Two more Baltic states apply for NATO inclusion. 16-point bold header. So then, why a NATO? Editorial header. EEC sides with Pacific Rim. Ups tariffs in response to U.S. quotas. Header. Gentle on waste storage from dismantled NATO therms. Not in my nation, babe. 12-point subheader. Amid smiles and two-handed handshakes that belied the high tension here, the leaders of 12 out of 15 NATO nations today signed an accord effectively dismantling the Western Bloc's 55-year-old defensive alliance. News summary cartridge voiceover. U.S.-Canadian support cuts doomed NATO summit from start, Icelandic poll declares. Header. So then why not a continental alliance now, maybe? Editorial header. Mexico signs on for Organization of North American Nations, Continental Alliance, but Quebec separatists rally against Finlandization of ONAN Alliance. But, gentle to Canada, unless ONAN treaty signed, NAFTA null. Manitoban therms stay put. Intracontinental pollution and waste disposal each nation's interests to pursue to the best they see fit. Header from veteran but methamphetamine-dependent headliner, finally demoted after repeated warnings about taking up too much space. Fed workers protest random fingernail hygiene screens. 12-point header. Gentle proposes nationalization of Interlace Telent. Header. Says government in line for piece of the action on video, cartridge, disc rentals. 8-point subheader. Burger King's Pillsbury awarded rights to New Year. Header. Pizza Hut's PepsiCo files bid rigging complaint with IRS. 12-point subheader. Calendar and pre-printed check industries stocks soar. 8-point subheader. Three blue-jawed convicts in antiquated stripes dicky their cells lock and run. Backed by sirens and searchlights, crisscrossed play. Not for the wall, but straight to the warden's empty nighttime office, where they sit, wrapped before his old dual-modem Macintosh, slapping their knees and pointing to the monitor and elbowing each other in the ribs, nibbling at inexplicably appeared boxes of popcorn, with a voiceover. Cartridges by modem. Just insert a blank diskette. Break free of the confinement of your channel selector. Some more of Ms. Heath's classes, puppets, and a B-film parody of the interlaced tell entertainment ads that the cable networks seem so mysteriously, suicidally, to run all the time that last year of unsubsidized time. ONAN Pact penned. 24-point superheader. Canada knuckles under. Tabloidish New York Daily's 24-point superheader. Acid rain. Landfills, barges, fusion tech, Manitoban therms were big sticks, Chrétien admits. 16-point header. Short-haired men in shiny trucks are not dismantling Manitoban therms, but instead moving them just over border into Turtle Mountain Indian Reservation, horrified North Dakota governor charges. 12-point subheader from demoted headliner already in Dutch down in the subheader department. Now, too. Exclusive color photos show brave docs futilely fighting time to remove railroad spike from Canadian Prime Minister's right eye. Tabloidish New York Daily 16-point header. President's office is a anally retentive horror show, says this just-retired White House custodian. Tabloid header with photo of old guy with basically one eyebrow, running all the way across his forehead, holding up a mammoth plastic barrel he claims held just one day's haul of dental stimulators, alcohol-soaked cotton puffs, GI X-ray-grade colonic purgative bottles, epidermal ash, surgical masks and gloves, Q-tips, Kleenex, and homeopathic pruritus cream containers. USO U.S. Chief Tyne, charges of an Oval Office littered with Kleenex and floss, a clear case of dirty tricks. Respectable daily header. Overloaded waste barges collide, capsize off Gloucester. Boston Daily header. Huge putrid slick empties beaches off both shores, Cape. Equally large subheader. Gentle speaks out on a U.S. constipatedly impacted on continental waste at UNLV commencement.
Header.
Ad Council report. Boston's Viney and Veals agency's liposuction and tongue stick campaigns not to blame for ABC HQ bomb threats. Advertising age header. The governors of Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire today reacted strongly to President Gentile's establishment of a blue-ribbon panel of waste experts to investigate the feasibility of mass landfill and conversion sites in northern New England. Respectable New York Daily's lead graph. We are not this continent's sigmoid colon, Gentile warns ONAN joint session. Header. Bethesda MDs, stricken president confined for hygienic stress following incoherent ONAN address. Header. Holography makes ultra-toxic fusion gambit safe for workers, community. DOE rep assures Methune PTA. Boston Daily header. Gentile out of Bethesda Naval Hospital confinement to address U.S. Congress on reconfigurative options for tight, tidier national era. Header. All these twirling journalistically out from a black acetate, one of Osteis's old Fila warm-up dots, background, in vintagely elusive old black-and-white film style, with a sonic background of that sad, sappy Italianate stuff Scorsese had loved for his own montages, with the headlines lap dissolving into transverse-angled shots of a modest, green-masked, Gentile, accepting tight-lipped handshakes from Mexican and Canadian officials, in an agreement to make the U.S. president the first chair of the Organization of North American Nations, with Mexican Presidente and new heavily guarded Canadian Prime Minister to be co-vice-chairs. Gentile's first state of the ONAN address, delivered before a triple-sized Congress on the very last day of B.S. solar time, holds out the promise of a whole bright, spanking new millennium of sacrifices and rewards and interdependences, not impossibly radically altered new look, continent-wide. Do not underestimate objects, Lyle says he finds it impossible to overstress this. Do not underestimate objects. Partridge, Kansas's serve and volley prodigy, Ortho the Darkness Stice, 16A's very top man, whose sauna-fresh torso gleams the same color as the moonlight off the idle weight's metal, is being driven right to the edge by the fact that he goes to sleep with his bed against one wall, but then wakes up with his bed against a whole nother wall. Stice had already had a whole series of beefs with roommate Kyle D. Coyle, because he'd figured clearly Coyle was moving Stice's bed around in Stice's sleep. But then Coyle got put in the infirmary with a suspicious discharge, and he's been out of the room for the last two nights, Coyle, and here Stice is still waking up with his bed against a different wall. So then he thought like Axford or Struck was dickying his door with a meal card and sneaking in really late and messing with Stice's bed out of obscure motives. So that last night Stice jammed a chair up against his door and piled empty tennis ball cans on the chair to make a racket if there was any dickying, and lined up still more cans on the sills of all three windows, just to cover all bases. So the reason he's here is this AM he wakes up with his bed moved over against the chair by the door at an angle he didn't care for one bit, and with all the ball cans arranged in a neat pyramid in the dusty rectangle where his bed was supposed to normally be. Ortho Stice can think of only three possible explanations for what's going on, and he presents them to an attentive, cheek-sucking Lyle in ascending order of grimness. One is that Stice is telekinetic, but only in his sleep. Two is that somebody else at ETA is telekinetic and has it in for Stice and wants to drive him batsoid for some reason. Three is that Stice is like getting up in his sleep and rearranging the room without knowing it, or remembering it, which means he's a severe fucking somnambulist which means Lord only knows what else he could get up and wander around and do in his sleep. He's got promise, the staff says. He's got a quite legit shot at the show when he graduates, which he does not want to mess up with any sort of telekinetic or somnambulistical shenanigans. Stiff offers up the planes of his torso and forehead. He wears one of his own personal towels, a black one. He is slim but wiry and beautifully muscled, and sweats freely and well. He says he knows too well he'd neglected Lyle's advice about the pull-down station 2 years back and regrets it. He wholeheartedly apologizes for the time last spring he got struck and Axford to distract Lyle, and then crazy glued Lyle's left buttocks spandex to the wooden top of the towel dispenser. Stice says he realizes he's the last guy with any right to come to Lyle, cap in hand, after all the cracks about the diet and hairstyle and all. But here he is, cap in hand, or rather, calotte in hand, offering up his sonnet planes, asking for Lyle's input. Lyle waves bygones away like a gnat you barely look at. He is completely engaged. The lightning now far off, out over the Atlantic, treats him like a weak strobe. Do not underestimate objects, he advises Stites. Do not leave objects out of account. The world, after all, which is radically old, is made up mostly of objects. Lyle leans in, waves Stice up even closer, and consents to tell Stice the story of this one man he once knew of. This man earned his living by going to various public sites where people congregated and were bored and impatient and cynical. He'd go in and bet people that he could stand on any chair in the place and then lift that chair up off the ground while standing on it. A bootstrap-type scenario. His M.O. is he climbs up on a chair and stands there and says publicly, "Hey, I can lift this chair I stand on." A bystander holds the bets. The idle bus depot or DMV waiting area or hospital lobby crowd is dumbstruck. They gaze up at a man who is standing 100% on top of a chair he has grabbed the back of and raised several meters off the ground. There is vigorous speculation about how the trick's done, which gives rise to side bet action. A devoutly religious experimental oncologist, dying of his own inoperable colorectal neoplastis, moans, "Why, oh, why, Lord, do you give this man this idiotic picayune power, and I no power over my own ravening colorectal cells?" There are numerous silent variations on this sort of meditation in the crowd. The bet won. The money finally forked over and handed up to him. The man Lyle says he once knew of now jumps back down to the floor. Incidental change spraying from his pockets on impact. Straightens his tie and walks off, leaving behind a dumbfounded crowd still staring up at an object he had not underestimated. Like most young people genetically hardwired for a secret drug problem, Hallen Candenza also has severe compulsion issues around nicotine and sugar. Because smoking will simply kill you during drills, only Bridget Boone, a steroidic girl 16 named Carol Spodek, and one or the other of the Vaught twins are masochistic enough to do it, though Teddy Schacht has been known to enjoy the occasional Penatella. The nicotine craving Hal tries to mollify as best he can by dipping Kodiak Wintergreen smokeless tobacco several times daily, spitting into either a cherished old childhood NASA glass or the empty can of a spirotine high-protein breakfast beverage that even now sits, given a wide berth by all others, next to a small pile of the tennis balls the table's kids don't have to squeeze as long as they're eating. Hal's more serious problem is with sucrose. The hope smoker's ever-beckoning siren. Because he craves it always and awfully, Hal does, sugar, but finds now lately that any sugar infusion above the level of a 56-gram AminoPal high-energy bar now induces odd and unpleasant emotional states that don't do him one bit of good on court. Sitting here, preacher hatted, with a mouth full of multi-layered baklava, Hal knows perfectly well that Mario gets his fetish for cartridges about puppets and entre acts and audiences from their late father. himself, during his anti-confluential middle period, went through this sub-phase of being obsessed with the idea of audiences' relationships with various sorts of shows. Hal doesn't even want to think about the grim one about the carnival of eyeballs.
154.
But this one other short, high-tech one was called The Medusa versus the Odalisk, and was a film of a fake stage production at Ford's Theater in the nation's capital of Washington, D.C., that, like all his audience-obsessed pieces, had cost Incandenza a real bundle in terms of human extras. The extras in this one are a well-dressed audience of guys in mutton chops and ladies with paper fans who fill the place from first row to the rear of the balcony's boxes, and they're watching an incredibly violent little involuted playlet called The Medusa versus the Odalisk. The relatively plotless plot of which is just that the mythic Medusa, snake-haired and armed with a sword and well-polished shield, is fighting to the death, or petrification against, L'Odalisque de Saint-Thérèse, a character out of old Quebecois mythology, who was supposedly so inhumanly gorgeous that anyone who looked at her turned instantly into a human-sized precious gem from admiration. A pretty natural foil for the Medusa, obviously. The Odalisque has only a nail file instead of a sword, but also has a well-wielded handheld makeup mirror, and she and the Medusa are basically rumbling for like 20 minutes, leaping around the ornate stage trying to de-map each other with blades and or de-animate each other with their respective reflectors, which each leaps around trying to position just right so that the other gets a glimpse of its own full frontal reflection and gets instantly petrified or gemified or whatever. In the cartridge, it's pretty clear from their milky pixel translucence and insubstantiality that they're holograms. But it's not clear what they're supposed to be on the level of the playlet, whether the audience is supposed to see/not see them as ghosts or wraiths or real mythic entities or what. But it's a ballsy fight scene up there on the stage, having been intricately choreographed by an Oriental guy himself rented from some commercial studio, and putting him up in the headmaster's house, who ate like a bird and smiled very politely all the time, and didn't have even a word to say to anybody, it seemed, except Avril, to whom the Oriental choreographer had cottoned right off, balletic and full of compelling little cornerings and near misses and reversals. And the theater's audience is rapt and clearly entertained to the gills, because they keep spontaneously applauding, as much maybe for the film's play's choreography as anything else. Which would make it more like spontaneously meta-applauding, Hal supposes, because the whole fight scene has to be ingeniously choreographed so that both combatants have their respectively scaly and cream-complected backs to the audience, for obvious reasons.
155.
Except as the shield and little mirror get whipped martially around and brandished at various strategic angles, certain members of the playlet's well-dressed audience eventually start catching disastrous glimpses of the combatant's fatal full frontal reflections, and instantly get transformed into, like, ruby statues in their front row seats, or get petrified and fall like embolized bats from the balcony's boxes, etc. The cartridge goes on like this until there's nobody left in the Ford's Theater seats animate enough to applaud the nested narrative of the fight scene play. And it ends with the two aesthetic foils still rumbling like mad before an audience of very colored stone. The Medusa versus the Odalisque's own audiences didn't think too much of the thing, because the film audience never does get much of a decent full-frontal look at what it is about the combatants that supposedly has such a melodramatic effect on the Rumble's live audience. And so, the film's audience ends up feeling teased and vaguely cheated, and the thing had only a regional release, and the cartridge rented like yesterday's newspapers, and it's now next to impossible to find. But that wasn't by any stretch of the imagination the James O. Incandenza film that audiences hated the most. The most hated Incandenza film, a variable-length one called The Joke, had only a very brief theatrical